Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But is it anything else that you... like wonder before we take off?
No.
Maybe you should just grab 2 glasses of water. 3 glasses of water.
Sure, yeah.
I can do it if you want, if you tell me.
Every time that I prepare a new interview, I do quite extensive research. So when we finally sit down to record, I always have a wide range of questions already written down. So that is also what I did for this sit down with Caroline Ciavaldini and her husband James Pearson. However, after just a couple of minutes into the interview, the questions went straight out of the window as this amazing, energetic couple in the most lovely way hijacked the entire interview, and I quickly decided to just hang on and enjoy the ride. My name is Magnus Ormestad, and this is episode 22 of the International series from the Swedish outdoor podcast Husky. Husky is recorded with support from Naturkompaniet and the new holiday club in Åre. Find out more about this episode and of previous episodes at huskypodcast.com.
I think we're okay.
So I'm here with the freshwater connoisseurs, Caroline and James. Not too much limestone in the water. Yeah, was that a good thing or a bad thing?
Is there a button to press when you don't have the answer?
I mean, I think technically there's going to be the perfect balance, both in terms of taste and health. But what that balance is, I have no idea. I just know in our house we had to get rid of it all because there was so much.
You have like filters built in.
Yeah, so we have a big filter at the beginning of just the entrance of the water in the house that takes it all away. So interesting.
I think it was more interesting because obviously the water is full of limestone. Ground is limestone.
Yeah.
And obviously here there's no limestone at all.
No, it's and granite, I think.
Because some of the buildings in the old city, it looked like, maybe I'm stupid, but it looked like there was some great sandstone.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
is that sandstone? Oh, me. Climb is obsession, you know?
is that true? Do you have an obsession for rock?
Like, oh, yeah, totally.
If you walk past a building like made out of rock, you can I wonder how that
James
feels.
James and I, we've got
around touching walls and things. Yeah, and if there's interesting features, imagine if that was a hole.
We have a lot of obsessions.
Yeah, I'm more nerdy than you.
Oh, but for sure, that's 100% sure.
Although Caroline's become a lot more curious about construction since we bought a house in the south of France and we've been working on renovating that.
Yeah, but then stone obsession is all about being a climber.
Maybe,
because when I was a young climber, it didn't seem to matter so much because I was more an indoor climber. Mm-hmm. So it was really about the effort. And with time and tasting different rocks...
I guess that's probably the key.
Yeah.
You realize it's really, really different. And I think you get closer to... I'm not going to go like esoteric and say you can feel the energy of the rock.
The soul of the rock.
But there's something to say about... with time, I think I like sandstone much better. Sandstone and granite, I think I like volcanic and... No, sandstone, not volcanic, so it doesn't make sense.
But it's about the friction, I guess.
Generally about the friction, but also about
the shapes,
the form.
The perfection of the shapes.
Mm. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Hey, don't want the sharp edges that will cut your equipment and cut your skin? You want
generally.
I mean, granite can be super sharp. Mm-hmm. I think it's more, it cuts the skin. So a really sharp rock is usually something you and I, we're quite sensible about it.
Yeah.
I think it's more like we are 30 years old, climbers who've traveled.
It's more like we're spoilt,
world.
I think.
Yeah.
We've become like spoilt kids.
But isn't the thing with like if you climb rocks that catch your skin and gives you chafing and so on, that looks super cool on Instagram and Facebook, those images?
When we post pictures of our bloody tips at the end of the day to make people think that we're authentic. Exactly. That's what it's all about.
I don't know. I don't like pain, so I mean.
You know, some with the filters on Instagram, you don't even actually need to have really chafed or bloody tips.
No.
You can just up the saturation in the red and it does it all for you.
Or just add the rock climber filter on Instagram.
Exactly. All bloody.
Hardcore. Hashtag hardcore.
Yeah.
Blood and chalk. That's the perfect combination. Yeah.
But it's very true that we are really spoilt as far as climbers go, I think. We're very basically in this fortunate situation where we constantly get to travel all over the world, visiting either the best existing places or going out there and finding new places. And so, yeah, when you go back home and you end up climbing on the stuff, you know, that you've always seen next to the
house. Some friends like, oh, I'm going to show you this new crack. It's amazing. You go there like, oh, my God, this is just so bad.
So now you've lost 50% of your friends now.
No!
But you have to try and take a step back and you have to try and find a way to be excited for them.
Yeah.
Because at the same time, a lot of people don't have the same chance that we have and we'd be just kind of assholes if
you live
we were like, well, no, this is really bad. I can't believe you climb on this. Like, what are you doing with your life? Oh, yeah, you can't go anywhere else. So you have to find a way to actually be, because you can always find a silver lining. You know, there's always a way to look at a situation positively. And so either just the motivation that they have for developing these places or, you know, sometimes even if the place is not really nice or beautiful or whatever, you can usually find a good route or a good move.
I think with time as well, I mean, just look, okay, that's maybe no subject at all, but you just see a house. It's a completely different subject. On first sight, it's a pretty house. And then you get to spend more time, you work more on it, you understand more secrets about it, and you love it. And it's the same for a crag, I think. Because opening a crag, a sport crag, or even a trad climb, it's about spending a lot of time, a lot of energy, cleaning the access, cleaning the rock, maintaining the belay if there's belays, maintaining the security pieces. And I think it's like anything. If it's your baby, you love it. So
even
sometimes,
if it's ugly.
The wood setters sometimes they're like kind of lose it. You're like, well, there's never going to be anybody going climbing on your roots, but I can't tell you because.
But great job. You know, it's awesome what you're doing. And we've done exactly the same.
Yeah.
We've developed lots of places around the world that no one will ever, ever, ever go visit, mainly because they're in the middle of nowhere, but.
Or maybe because they're bad.
Yeah.
But you won't know.
But we had so much fun doing it. And I don't know, it's always this. I often pose the ultimate question is, what purpose does climbing really have? Like,
none.
None, ultimately. I mean, the things that we do, and we're going to talk for, an hour on it today, ultimately, it's kind of meaningless. I mean, we're just basically wasting our time. And anybody's time that's watching us. But on the other side, we're not really wasting it because we're having a load of fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Through climbing, we are happier for sure. And hopefully then we share some of that happiness with other people. And I feel like, you know, people say like a smile is like throwing a pebble in a pond. You know, just one and then you watch the ripples spread out. And I think it's true. If we can, I mean, we're never going to be, I'm getting all the good stuff right in the beginning. So
it's just, I'm just thinking, oh my God, when am I stopping? Just stop.
But we're never going to be.
Line.
We're never going to be like do anything really important with our life. We're not doctors. We're not politicians. We're not going to change the world. But if we can somehow change our little world just by being happier, then you know that seems to be enough reason to actually go out there every day and pull on these little strange rocks.
Speaking of inspiring people, you hosted a event last night with the North Face store in Stockholm.
Yes.
How did that go?
It was.
You opened up some minds. Turned some people on to climbing.
We should let Caroline answer this because it's the first one of those events that.
Oh really?
She's actually done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and it was really interesting to see how a kind of perception of the idea and the concept has changed.
So how did you like it, Capo?
Oh, I'm allowed to talk. Great, it's my turn. So, No, it's not my first event for a start, but it's my first event where I was supposed to go. The other ones I went but didn't actually help. I think 1 year ago, when North Face started doing that, I mean, we're athletes, we're not marketing people.
Doing mountain athletics.
Yeah, doing mountain athletics. We didn't believe it was going to work so well, and it did. The concept is very simple. It's proposing to people free access to a good trainer who is supposedly going to train them for their to help them accomplish their outdoor project. And it's quite varied. It can be climbing, it can be trail running, it can be mountaineering. I don't know actually if it's already specialized, but I think they're aiming at specializing it. But in general, it's kind of really giving the opportunity to people from big cities where it's sometimes hard to, well, A, take the time, B, get the motivation after work to go work out, but not just with the objective of working out, more like work out because you've got this thing that you want to do at some point and you need to prepare for it.
The hashtag I train for.
Exactly.
Concept.
And it looks like a very big marketing thing, but at the same time, being athletes, this is exactly what we do all the time. Realistically, we do that all the time, and until 2 years ago, North Face or brands in general did never communicate about all the training hours, as if like, yeah, but I mean, you being in the gym, no one wants to see that.
Exactly true. I mean, there are other brands out there that have had these kind of run or fitness clubs based in stores for a few years now. And I guess that's probably why we were a little hesitant at first with North Face's decision to go down that line. We thought they were just trying to copy what had already been done, to jump on that bandwagon. And, you know, in 6 months, they were going to decide on a new corporate strategy and then go in a different direction. And there was going to be no kind of heart behind it. But I think the big difference is instead of just I'm going training, it's like you said, it's I train for. There's always an ultimate goal for the training, because I'll be the first to admit I don't really enjoy training that much. But if there's a reason behind it, if there's a big goal that I'm working towards at the end, then I can justify that time. I'd rather be out there in the mountains, and we're lucky that we can do that every day. But there are moments where we even have to kind of confine ourselves to the gym and work hard towards this goal. And so for the people that don't have the chance like that we do to be out there in the hills or in the forests or, you know, wherever, this is such a cool method,
I think it's a real thing. But
it's such a strong thing to build a community and give people an identity. And then through all of that comes more motivation to push themselves and to develop themselves. And who knows where it's going to go.
Yeah, I think the big addition is not actually the training, because people who really had a goal, they already trained. It's the community. But because training together is easier.
Mm.
And some nights, I mean, obviously, I'm not working in an office, and I'm really lucky for that. But I can imagine what it's like, and when you've done a full day
trying to find the motivation to go to the gym and you know, bust it out for a few hours after
what you actually
10 hours
really
in the
dream
office.
Of is being outside, and you're not gonna have it this evening. But what you can have is knowing that you're building a little piece of your project. So
it's always easier to motivate yourself if you know that your friends are going there Wednesday evening.
And they can be, you know, perhaps friends that you're going to meet at the events. And that's also super cool. You can have the idea that, you know, I want to train for a project in the outdoors, but you might not necessarily know what that is. And then through people that you meet at these things, everybody gets together and has ideas like, I don't know, let's plan a trip to go climbing in Wadi Rum, or let's go plan a trip to run the trail race on Monte Rosa.
Yeah,
and people are going to be like, wow, I can't do that. And people are like, yes, you can. Like, you know, come join us. We'll show you how. And through that, you kind of, you open your self expectations and your limits of possibility.
This is the other
approach.
That's
super, super interesting.
This is the other approach that North Face is actually bringing. I mean, North Face or the brands is bringing is not the training for training. Because we, 2017 now, a lot of people in different countries, they work out for working out because they want a pretty body, because it's healthy. And maybe I'm just thinking, if you hear about this mountain athletic training, if you're just working out for working out, you might be like, oh, actually, I mean, why not? I could actually have a goal behind it. And so you could argue that this concept kind of could bring people go do things outdoors that they wouldn't have done so much before. And to me, this is really positive. I mean, I'm ecologic. How do you say?
Ecologically minded. I mean, you're an ecologist?
I think I was going to say I've got a...
Sometimes you think...
A tree hugger.
No, I mean, I'm just... Okay, I'm just a biology student. Being a biology student, I can't be against ecology. This would be... You know, we just came back from the US, so it's like you put things into perspective. But if you bring people who grew up and work in the city outdoors, you finally give them the chance to love it and then protect it.
It's about reconnecting people, I think. Did you have that growing up? Like, because you grew up, you didn't grow up in England or boring Sweden. You grew up in Reunion.
Oh, well.
No, Sweden is not boring.
That's fantastic. All a question of perspective. I would never say boring Sweden. But yeah, that's Reunion Island. It's a small dot on the other side of the world, realistically. And it's a tropical French island. And it's... I think you were really positively surprised the minute you came off the plane the first time I brought you there. Because you land there and you can see this island where you've got just... So it's a volcano. It's a live volcano.
It's a really bizarre experience the first time I found.
And the surroundings of the island, which are the flattest, they are inhabited. And there's a million people on the island, so it's a lot of people. But the main... Like, if you look... From the air, the island is a volcano full of tropical vegetation. Oh. So there's the least you can say is there's trees everywhere. There's banana trees.
The main body of the island's uninhabited because you can't really. It's too steep, too complicated.
It's not even that it's easy to access the outdoors. It's that the outdoors is in your garden.
Yeah, but so. I think what shocked me most about Reunion, at least the first time I went, was you step off the plane, you leave the airport, you drive, you know, down the first few streets through the city and then out onto the highway. And everything reminds you of France. Like, it's basically like driving around Montpellier or Marseille, but with palm trees everywhere and the sounds of the jungle. You see all the road signs, the way that the roads and the streets are constructed. Even the buildings look kind of similar. The bakeries aren't exactly the same.
Yeah, but they look the same.
But then as soon as you drive more than sort of 10 minutes off the beaten track, suddenly you're in this...
Jurassic Park set.
Yeah, yeah, really.
No, it's actually even more varied than just Jurassic Park. It's like luxurious jungle and then kind of savanna sometimes.
Wow.
You go through so many different layers. If you drive actually up to the volcano, you can drive to not the summit, the moon, but you can drive to one of the plains just below. You start off down in tropical beach, go up into jungle, rainforest, and you come through that and you end up in somewhere that really reminded me of the Lake District or Wales, like kind of rolling green hills, really lush.
With cows,
like big hairy Highland cattle. And then you keep on going and it gets kind of fairly arid and then literally becomes the plain. They call it the plan de sable?
La plaine de sable.
La plaine de sable, which is like... They've actually used it in quite a few sci-fi films as a stand-in for Mars because it's just this flat, red desert with the peaks of the volcano sticking out above. It's totally crazy. And there's craters as well from little mini explosions that have come out over time. It's totally bizarre. So it's a very varied place. And it's a place, I think, that's really hard not to develop a love for the outdoors.
So that was your childhood was like that, like going out in the outdoors, like hiking and so on.
Yeah, I've got this, I mean, they're everywhere, these memories. Just, I think maybe for Sweden, it's going to be very unusual, like to go to school. I mean, I didn't grow up, some people ask me if there was electricity and if I had a bone in my nose.
Because that was my next question.
like James really said, this is really modern. Okay, it wasn't super modern when I was a kid. But I grew up and... I had like a 15-minute walk to go to my school when I was 12-year-old, and I had to go through sugarcane fields.
Oh, really?
And
steal a cane on the way? Did you steal a cane on the way?
No, you can't, because the sugarcane that's used for making sugar is not actually the one really, really good
to eat.
every now and again you'll find the one that you can eat like a candy, but this one is way drier. So, so what was the question?
No, basically your childhood, how it was. Yeah, you spent a lot of time in nature.
Yeah, I'm just talking about it. I get lost in my memories.
These are the kind of interviews that I like. When people get lost.
This is where I grew up. Yeah, I mean, I had a normal house with a good garden. I had a tree house, but maybe until then, this is not crazily unusual for people. But on weekends, we would go on walks. And I mean, when you're a kid, this is your reality. This is normal. But it's only actually being a grown up, leaving the island and coming back that I can realize how astonishing it was. Stunning, whatever. Because, like, the walking paths, in England, James had kind of, you could say, a similar growing up, except he would have watertight shoes and waterproof things and waterproof hats, and they would have to go whatever the weather.
Waterproof hats. I like the idea. I never had a waterproof hat, but...
Okay, well. Maybe not.
Should we call it an umbrella?
I don't know. Okay, you had an umbrella to walk. No, you didn't have an umbrella to walk.
No.
But you must have had a hat. Okay, hood. Great. And, I mean...
It's that thing on the back of your jacket that you never put on your
James,
head.
James, it's too advanced for wearing yarn. They didn't have stuff like that.
This is the thing. I didn't
they
have...
They just had first.
2021, it's going to be there.
The next big thing, umbrellas.
It does rain all the time, but it's tropical.
It's hot.
So it's going to rain for 1 hour, like downpour rain, but it doesn't matter if you get wet because you're not cold. So I must have had one rain jacket made of basically plastic cloth. nothing technical. And you couldn't breathe in it anyway because you would get so sweaty. You would get more wet wearing it than without it. And... So yeah, when I think about your childhood, to me it seems like so miserable, but at the same time, it was a... I
mean, she's not talking about me, she's talking about James.
Yeah,
I think we often say that I think that reunion would be an awesome place to raise kids because they just have so many possibilities to do different exciting things. And it's not just that, like you could be hiking in the jungle on the side of the mountain one day. You could be climbing, rappelling, canyoning the other day, and then the next day you can be swimming in a tropical reef.
A sport?
It is
actually,
a sport. Sport rappelling.
Just a personal joke.
Even now you can still go swimming in the reef and see the fish. The sharks aren't dangerous there. You can't go surfing anymore. That's maybe one of the bad things.
Parapenting? That's how you said?
Yeah.
No, paragliding. How do you say in English?
Paragliding. It's amazing, but
really,
I guess
really
it's harder to get into as a kid. I was thinking of the things you can easily do. And whereas...
But what do you mean you can't... I'm sorry, you can't go surfing anymore?
Yeah, okay. There's a very specific trouble that's happening on Rainier now. Since
six years.
For some reason, there's sharks everywhere now. So I've not actually spent hours and hours researching, so I'd rather not tell you something like a wrong cause. I think it's not very clear why.
No one
There's
seems
always
to really
been
know
sharks,
the cause.
But now they eat humans. So it's kind of a really sad story because it was a paradise for surfing. They had World Cups for surfing. And now, out of the places where there's a bar...
But even a lot of the beaches where you were swimming as a kid?
Yeah.
Now they're all closed. You're not allowed to go swimming.
Like,
it's so dangerous.
I've got so many memories going every weekend with my dad, and we would go scuba diving. He would take my hand and show me all the little fish and all.
And now the little fishes have grown big, and they eat people.
And hungry.
The thing is, nobody knows why. Well, there's always
strange.
Been sharks.
Never
I saw
heard
sharks
of that.
When I was little. Mm. Yeah, nobody cared, I guess. All in all, this is not exactly the end of the world, but it's a big issue on Reunion because it's really affecting tourism. But it's more like a misconception of what Reunion Island is about. It's a tropical island with nice beaches, but this is not the reason why you should go on Reunion Island because it's a mountain island.
Yeah.
The amazing.
If you want
amazing
beaches, there are way better places you can go
Mauritius.
For a beach holiday.
Yeah.
Reunion is just magical for what's inside.
Yeah, we don't have the big sand things. We have a few, but not that many. And now we have the sharks. It's not exactly perfect. But I think it's really considered one of the very best destinations for paragliding.
And canyoning.
Canyoning is amazing. And then you got this trail running, very famous
Yeah, they have an ultra trail there called the
Diagonal de Fou.
Yeah. And it's one of the hardest and most dangerous.
I've interviewed Emily Forsberg, the Salomon sponsored Emily Forsberg. Okay. She won it, I think, 2013, I think.
Oh, right, okay.
Kilian's girlfriend.
Yeah. Okay. We spoke with Seb about the Diagonal.
Seb Chignot?
Yeah.
Diagonal de Fou. He was saying it was really cool, really crazy race.
So, yeah.
I'm not going to ask that many questions about your upbringing, James. I'm sorry. It's not, for some reason, it doesn't sound
kind of boring.
It doesn't sound as exotic.
No,
as
but like, it's just more like, I think the point I was trying to make with that is that reunion gives kids so many chances naturally. Whereas in the UK, for sure, you can have a lot of chances growing up and experience a lot of things, but you have to spend a lot of money to do that. And because my family growing up, we didn't have so much money. Yeah, it was more basic stuff that you could do for free at the weekend. So I spent a lot of time hiking with my parents, with my waterproof boots and trousers. And
waterproof
and
hats.
But actually, I would say you actually had at least as much an outdoorsy upbringing as
It was incredibly outdoor. We were always outdoors doing things, but it was not as varied as that. You got the chance really to try everything that you could dream of trying as a kid.
Mm-mm.
And in addition to that, reunion is such a sheltered place culturally and racially that I think it's just a great place to bring up kids. Caroline, she almost touched on it earlier but then went off subject. She was saying that her school, or maybe I missed...
Did you say that?
No, I was reading ahead. I thought you were going to say that, but...
I'm that amazing.
You didn't. She was going to say that when she was at school...
What's the subject? I still don't know.
Just like wait and see.
We talked about, for example, when we first started to spend time together, you talked about different upbringings and things like that, and
you're
asked you about
the
like
diversity in my school.
Yeah, racism issues, and you're like, well, growing up on reunion, to be racist was a word or a phrase that I didn't understand, because
actually,
everybody
no, realistically, was, there is a sort of racism on reunion. I think, sadly, communities, there's always problems, but in my school there is a, I think in my classroom that I kept kind of the whole scolarity, there was black, white, yellow,
people from all sorts of ethnic
no minority different. No majority
exactly. No, and loads of religions. I remember when I was a kid going to, I could hear the mosque, and mm-hmm. Some of my friends, their mom, they had a not a full veil, but I had a veil, and the kiddos didn't have a veil yet. Mm. I think you just have it later, I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
And some of them, of my friends, we would go to the Hindu weddings, amazing weddings, because so many flowers everywhere, there would always be somebody walking on fire. I still don't quite understand that one, but and James had, I'm not even, you had one black kid in your whole school.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
obviously,
I come from a very kind of small town, inland UK, and it was just that was it. The overriding population was predominantly white, and so the only foreigner was somebody to. It wasn't in a bad way or a negative way, but clearly they were an outsider.
They
so
were
clearly
the other
from the beginning. Exactly, we had this idea of us and them,
and
sadly, that's an issue that seems to be presenting itself more and more frequently and more violently.
I think it's
now
just
in the UK and all over,
where
you just didn't have that, which I find so cool. Maybe it's the case, the grass is always greener, so I look at that and think of everything that I didn't have, and I'm sure there's lots of issues and problems as well there, but I don't know.
You only had fist fights and fish and chips.
Fist fights and fish and chips, exactly.
I don't know. Well, we're picturing it fairly wrong, because you had an amazing childhood.
I had a wonderful, wonderful childhood.
I owe my parents
so much.
Yeah, exactly. I would say
it's my parents that gave me that. I think the love for the outdoors.
I mean, I'm not saying my parents were not good. They were amazing and they did everything. But because James' parents were very, they did put a lot of time in their children's education. They had no money whatsoever. But they spent the time, they spent the energy, and they gave their
children. They invested energy and time
and
love
instead
of money.
I think the excuse of saying that I had a shit background and my parents, I don't know if it's an excuse, but I'm pretty sure you can always do a good job with your children if you just spend the time.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Okay, I don't have any keys. Better shut up for now.
Did you both have... were you the kind of kids that kind of dreamt away about, like, had big dreams about adventures? Like reading
well,
books?
Well, my dreams, as a young kid, my dreams were always based around climbing.
Although, no, you wanted to be an astronaut.
I don't think I ever wanted to be an astronaut. I don't think I ever had those bizarre, like, childhood fantasies.
I think at some point I wanted to be a president, but...
No, at some point, like, a little bit later, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. But that was actually when I was really genuinely thinking about possible careers. It wasn't, you know, this throwaway thing. But no, from a very early age, I dreamt of being a rock climber. I think even before I really understood what rock climbing meant. It's quite funny. My mum, she found recently some old drawings. I think I must have been 3 years old, marked on the on the paper, of drawing mountains with people climbing. And in the picture, you've got the guys climbing on a top rope coming down from the top of the mountain. So I'd seen he was sport rappelling off the top of, and this mountain looks like the Igarus, you know, this tiny thin, like pointy thing. And there's a helicopter up there that's, I don't know, doing something.
No, but that's pretty cool, yeah.
You know, I had all these ideas or these visions, and I was trying to piece them all together and figure out what it meant. And as far back as I can remember, I remember trying to ask my parents if I could go climbing, but because neither of them climbed and didn't really know anybody that climbed, and in the UK, because actually probably at least my view on this is based on the fact that we mainly go trad climbing, which is quite different to sport climbing. The public perception of climbing in England is one of kind of reckless risk taking and danger, and so it's not really something that you want your kids to get into. So unless you have, you know, close relations or friends that can take you under their wing, it's impossible. Or it was impossible. Now it's better with all the climbing walls that are sprouting up everywhere. But no, for probably at least 10 years or so, I was totally, you know, set on the idea of being a climber, but it was impossible to start. And then,
but you don't know where those influences came from?
No. I think it was partly because I grew up in the Peak District, which is one of the climbing meccas of England, and so when we'd go on hikes with my parents,
I'd always see those.
It's a really natural thing to do to go climbing for a kid, you know, whether it be on a boulder or a tree or a climbing frame or whatever. And so I'd do that, and I really liked it. And I think I was probably always quite good, so you generally like stuff that you do well. Mm. And at the same time, I'd see people really climbing out in the Peak District.
Really a lot, even at the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like we'd, for example, every time you drive through Matlock Bath, which is a little town near to where I lived, there's a big cliff above the road. And every time we'd drive through, I'd look and try and spot all the climbers and be like, oh, there's one. Oh, there's one. He's wearing red. And I remember trying to understand how it all worked. Like, how did they make themselves safe and things like that at a really early age?
It's and funny then, because at the same time, he comes from a rugby family.
Yeah.
So his granddad and his dad, everybody's always been playing rugby every Wednesday, training several times per week and playing matches every weekend.
Yeah.
And your mom, she was always on the side with her two kids, like cheering for daddy, who was the captain of his team. So James, he started rugby and he should have been a rugby player. I mean, I'm not saying a professional, but you should have been all about rugby. But clearly something was drawing him to climbing.
Yeah.
Both. And the mountains are calling.
Exactly. And I must go. And so around 15 or 16, I made some new friends at a different school. And basically, I'd kind of almost forgotten about climbing at that point. I mean, I was still climbing on stuff, you know, like kids do, just fooling around. But it kind of, the actual drive to go rock climbing had sort of disappeared. And I was doing other stuff at the time. I was playing rugby. I was doing lots of like inline skating or things like that. And some point, one of my friends was like, oh, I went climbing at the weekend. And I was like, oh, wow, cool, climbing. You know, I always wanted to try that thing. And he said, oh, next time we go, I'll take you. And he did. And literally that evening...
You never looked back.
I just found a thing that was for me. Throughout my entire childhood, I'd been changing through lots of different sports. And I think I'd always kind of had... I remember actually while when I was inline skating, I must have been about 10 or 11, and I was okay. I wasn't great, but I was going to the skate park and I was doing my tricks and stuff like that. And I started to hear the word sponsorship, and I'd read like skate magazines, and I'd see people being like sponsored. And I didn't really know what it meant, but I knew it meant they got free stuff from somebody. So I remember asking friends of my dad at the rugby club one night that owned local businesses, "Oh, do you want to sponsor me for rollerblading? Because I'm really good. You should sponsor me and give me some stuff."
I don't think it was a dream, but I remember the first time I asked about sponsorship. I think I was already a bit better at climbing than you were. I must have won my first Romanian championship, and with my mum, we wrote a 3-line text, something like, "My name's Karen Ciavolini, I'm 12 or whatever. I'm a Romanian champion in climbing. Can you please sponsor me?" And I sent it to everybody.
That's how you came in contact with the North Face.
Well, that would be
12. They said, "We'll keep an eye on you."
Yeah.
Actually, I remember my dad's accountant gave me a bit of money.
Yeah. But actually, wow. I mean, we laugh about it now, but there's a few climbers in the UK that actually make probably a good chunk of the money that they make from random firms like that, from accountancy companies or, I don't know, local garages.
I don't know if that's an urban myth or not. Maybe
no. I mean, I know I'm not going to name them by names, but it definitely exists. They struggle to find sponsorship through the regular, you know,
the obvious ones.
And
but
so
they don't go.
I think they
to
put
the,
a thing in the local paper. They were like, "Look at this guy. You know, he's just done this and this and this, but he can't do it for a living. You know, can anybody help?" And some local businesses were like, "Yeah, we'll do it." So now he's it's funny.
Your way into climbing, was it similar? Because you started right away with a indoor climbing gym, didn't you?
So I think my bringing to climbing is just as different from James as it's possible. Climbing is a Was that in English? Was there a lot of English mistakes in that sentence?
No, it's okay.
Okay.
But then again, my English is pretty poor nowadays. Thanks to the influence of a certain little French lady.
I started climbing through school.
Like a gym class?
Yeah. I don't know how developed is climbing at school in Finland.
Or Sweden.
In Sweden. Sorry.
Jesus Christ.
Okay,
it's
been
real
2 days.
Trouble with
I am saying
this.
Finland instead of Sweden, and I know where it is, and I know the capital, but for some reason...
I will leave that in. I will not edit that out.
Oh, no, don't do that.
But don't worry, ma'am. You'll get another opportunity.
Okay, cool.
She'll drop in Norway
maybe
later
I've got this hidden attraction to this Finnish amazing climber. And
probably.
He looks like you so
much. Oh, yeah, Norle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh?
If I flop my hair down like this on one side, I've got kind of a gnarly look.
Right, luckily, person, nobody
awkward.
Can see me. So what was I saying? So climbing is very, very developed in schools, and so I remember I had one running semester, one rugby semester, and one climbing semester, and I think it's always
for me. It's just crazy to imagine that.
I think it's coming out.
Climbing
more
is
and more
so
now.
Far down the ladder. School priorities in England.
But it's the fourth sport at school in France, so it's very big, and it's expensive infrastructure, but it's not that expensive realistically compared to a football.
Yeah, nowadays most of the schools in France have a climbing gym.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if most, but a lot. And so I started, and I was really good at it, so I liked it.
Do you know what it was that kind of spoke to you? Like, what was it in climbing that you... Was it just that you
the
were good?
The fact that you were good at it.
Yeah. If I'm really honest, so at the time, I was playing tennis a lot. I was dancing. I had just stopped doing horse riding. Did I say I was dancing?
Mm-hmm.
I was sailing a lot. I had a lot of activities, and climbing was just one of them. And why did I slowly let go of everything else for climbing? I think a big part of it was the group in which I was. Because, I mean, my climbing world was really, really small. It was, obviously, it's a really interesting activity, but I'm not going to spit on other sports. There's amazing, I mean... Tennis, well, no, I hate tennis, but I'm sure loads of people can love tennis. Sailing is amazing. The only thing is sailing on Reunion Island, where I was, there was not enough wind, so there was a lot of boredom time. But sailing is a great sport, I think. It was more like the people around me. I think I had teachers that were really keen, who brought me all around the island. That's pretty lucky when you think about it. A teacher who takes on her time and takes the kids for 10 days all around the island. I mean, there is better holidays than that for a teacher. But she did it. And so she gave us the love of the rock, which was, I mean, from plastic indoor climbing, there's a big first step into actually touching rock and liking it. She gave us the opportunity to start competing as well. And so as soon as I started climbing, I started competing. And I spent like 15 years in the competition world. And that's very, very intense. Whatever the sport is, always it's kind of a similar story. It's a inner journey into a pursuit of mental and physical excellence. And that's, I don't even think you actually question, do you like the sport or not? You're on it. I just remember reading the biography of André Agassi. Mm-hmm. And that's a very good example of a professional athlete who's been very successful, hating his sport all the time. So I am definitely not saying I hated climbing. I'm just saying I don't even think in the beginning that I did question how much I liked it. And with the time now, I mean, I've discovered loads of other aspects of climbing, like James tried climbing, which is completely different. It's way more natural, you could say. And
but what came first, James or trad climbing?
Oh no, no.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare insurance plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare insurance plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Games game first, obviously. I would have never started trad climbing without James. So there's this, I think what people know about climbing in general is either indoor climbing or sport rock climbing, which is, I'm not going to say 100% safe, but you should be fine. You should really not have an accident.
You have like pre-bolted roots and so on, yeah, top rope and everything. So it's
you're going to be either top rope or on the lead, but you're placing security, you're placing carabiners into metal rings that are glued or stuck in the rock. So, I mean, on paper, unless there's a human mistake, everything's completely fine. Trad climbing is not like that. And you didn't start climbing for the security. You started climbing for the danger. It was, I think, at the time, trad climbing was seen and is still seen as it's an extreme sport. It's not quite base jumping, but it's got something
in common. I don't
think
we can say I started trad climbing for the danger, but just trad climbing is how climbing was done in England at the time.
But as a kid, you were very adventurous.
Yeah.
You had no problem with sawing little bits of rock.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
even before I really, really climbed, that was fine.
Mm. But what is it? But is it true that you had an element of kind of a daredevil in you? Did you kind of like the tingling sensation?
But I've always been attracted to extreme sports, whatever you want to call them, sports that give you an adrenaline rush. But ironically, trad climbing is not one of those sports. In fact, you rarely feel any adrenaline whilst you're climbing. And generally, if you feel if you've got that adrenaline rush, it's because something's gone wrong, because you've put yourself in a situation that you shouldn't be in. Trad climbing is much more about controlling the risk. It's the most simple way to describe it is, you know, if you walked along a thin wall at ground level, why not do that at 100 meters off the floor? You know you can do it. There's nothing that's changed. It's just your perception of the risk and how that risk then affects your physical performance. And I think that's what's really interesting. A lot of the routes I was doing when I was younger. This is kind of after starting climbing and after making those first steps and discovering kind of what it all meant. When I started to actually push myself and do harder and harder trad routes, it was a question of, I know I can do this route, but can I do it when it counts? Which is ironically very similar to what Caroline was experiencing later on with her competitions, but with very different, failure brought very different results. For me, failure was potentially mortal. For Caroline, failure was a lost competition, but at the same time, it was devastating as well.
Well, I was in debt. That's already something. But hold on. There's something about your description. You just described it. I don't want people to take it wrong. You described it as walking along a white line, as if like you're 100% sure you can do it. When you said you were sure you could do the routes, this is not really true. I mean, some of the routes you did...
Yeah, okay. So this was more like walking along a white line that was, you know, slightly broken up, and you might have to hop and spin around at some points.
And closed eyes.
With closed eyes, occasionally. So there were definitely moments that take you closer to the edge than others. But generally speaking, it's doing something that you know physically you should be able to do.
Three times out of four.
Yeah, well, I mean, you'd work out the percentage, roughly. So a lot of the time when I was younger and I was trying dangerous traditional routes, I would practice them before with a safety rope. And depending on the odds, if I fell off one time in 10 or one time in 5 or one time in 2, then I could decide, you know, is the risk worth the reward?
And somebody could tell you the risk of dying is never worth the reward, but this is a sport.
Yeah, yeah. So and that was the game.
I think he had a...
And there were risks.
That of a composant.
And there were routes that I did 17, 18, 19 years old that I wouldn't ever dream of doing nowadays. They were just too far. But at that time, maybe it's the fact that I was just younger, and I don't know. I think young males are typically some of the most arrogant, and
I think
it's maybe the most dangerous time of your life. I mean, just look at driving a car. You think you're invincible. You think you're all, you know.
That's the thing. Risk taking is all down to what you think. I think even Alex Honnold will tell you he doesn't take any risk because he doesn't think he takes any risk. And James would tell you, I don't take any risk. So actually, it's not, you can't ask him how much risk do you think you take.
Yeah, it's based on your experiences that you're living at the time. And then
about an ever expanding comfort zone as well.
Yeah.
And competence zone.
And then
like knowing
also
your
later
limits.
On, perhaps, you know.
Well, hopefully not, but hopefully you're on past the limit. But
yeah. I feel like my comfort zone's compressed quite a lot from those days. Like I'm a lot less likely to take those potentially mortal risks. When I do now, it's really something that has to be worth it, or something that I'm absolutely sure is going to go fine.
Maybe you could say that when you were really young, there was a bit of a gambling part to it.
Yeah.
Like actually, you didn't actually. You're talking about percentages, but yeah. I don't think you did calculate that well. The risk, and
maybe
you did fully understand the consequences, and we've
or at least the percentage for failure was much, much higher. I mean, there's always percentage chances that something can go wrong. Simply, you know, a hold breaks, or, you know, there's a million things that could happen that probably never will, but it can. And so even if you're climbing the easiest route in the world, but you're solo, you're taking huge risks. But, you know, if we were worried about that, then we'd all want to live in a little bubble. You know, life's ultimately for living.
Do you think because now you share this life and you share this passion, you're both climbers from a very young age, do you think like both you've evolved, you've matured, but do you think that climbing, like when you two go climbing, you kind of take on different roles than when you are at home? Is it a problem, like climbing as husband and wife? Are you more or less likely to expose yourself, or I mean, comparing if you climb with a mate, with a friend, mm-hmm. even if it's a close friend, it's not Caroline.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You know what I'm getting at? Is it sometimes difficult? Do you have to like take on like a professional role when you communicate amongst yourself?
Or? So I think to answer, I would ask you, when is the last time you climbed with somebody who wasn't me?
Without you,
without me,
then I don't remember.
So
we have a
really really close relation, and it might be hard
24 hours a day, at least 300 days a year together.
it's very extreme, and I think 90% of people don't understand it. I don't know why it's like that. First, we had really different lives. I mean, James was an outdoor climber. He was always going on trips. I was a competition climber. I was always going on trips. We had actually not much time in common, and we didn't like it. So we've both made our sponsors evolve.
Well, yeah, we took steps to bring our lives closer together. So aligning sponsorship.
And I was just
doing more joint projects.
I was just thinking recently, James started to want to bike a bit more. Have a little bit of a side activity. But then he had to convince me to go do it with him because he wouldn't do it without me.
So. No, but I mean, being in a very exposed situation.
Yeah, the fear of something happening to Caroline. Well, I think, maybe before we talk about that, we should talk about how you got into trad climbing, because it wasn't just instantaneously. It wasn't just because I'm a trad climber, suddenly you start to do it. At first, you thought I was totally crazy.
So I think you must have grasped it. We're quite opposite. James is all the risk taker, and he's pulling towards risk. I'm pulling towards security. So, and this works just as much in climbing as in real life.
Yeah.
So we function just the same way in real life and climbing. There's no putting a hat on, or at least I'm not aware of it.
No.
I don't.
Not a waterproof hat.
Oh, wow.
Your dad actually has a waterproof hat.
It does. That's why it does exist.
Yeah.
So where were we going?
And so, for the first probably 2 years of our relationship, we were only sport climbing, and that was great because Caroline actually was still competing, so she still had to maintain her form. And my biggest problem that I still to this day I think the biggest problem I've ever experienced in climbing was the fact that I'd never trained or developed myself physically. I'd always relied on kind of natural ability and risk-taking, or being bold. And so I had no idea how to take that step away from it. I was basically in a situation where I was, as a professional climber, you're supposed to try and always, you know, go further, faster, stronger, do more and more and more. Every project has to be somehow greater than the last. And when the only thing you know how to do is basically take risks, the long-term chances of something happening are fairly high. I remember one day realizing that and thinking I needed to do something about it, but not knowing quite how. And I'd tried to train. I tried to build my sport climbing ability in the past and just never really succeeded. And so getting to know Caroline gave me this new opportunity to kind of change who I was as a climber, to, you know, add a new string to my bow and potentially maybe make my life a little bit longer, which was super interesting. Because over the first couple of years, we were just sport climbing, and that was awesome. I kind of almost was trad climbing less than ever, but it was just didn't matter at all. I was motivated on a new thing, and I was excited by a new thing.
Yeah, you were improving fast,
and I could see the progression, which is always a really good thing. And then at some point, I think I used that newfound level in sport to then take it back to trad, and that had always been my dream. And I had a project in the UK that we planned and Caroline coached me through it for about 6 months. She built me a training program.
So at that point, I was still not track climbing at all. And I think I had even said I don't want to track climb because I mean, I'm scared. I mean, I'm a normal person, so I was afraid of the concept. But James was getting more and more into it mentally, and I was seeing him do it. So I thought at some point, I will never understand James fully if I don't try track climbing. So I tried, and to my surprise, I really, really liked it. Because there's this, I mean, just like you explained it, just trad is, you've got sport climbing, which is all about the physical level, and obviously there's a lot of mental control, but it's control of your physical, like how you display your energy, and on top of that you can add controlling fear and handling danger, and so it's like as if you just added an extra dimension of complexity.
Yeah, and then on top of that you add the whole kind of complex issue of choosing and selecting and placing and managing all the protection that you have to place, which is again a whole kind of world in its own right. And so you had all these new skills to learn and to develop, and I think Caroline, when she was approaching the end of her sport climbing career, you'd have probably, with or without trad, finished.
Yeah, I would have
competition climbing.
I would have never stopped climbing, but I would have stopped competitions more because the way, so I think you're gonna have a really long conversation about what competition is about, and I have met competitors who told me I wish the best to everybody. But I wasn't like that. And I don't actually know if there are really competitors who are truly wishing the best to everybody.
I saw one of the movies I saw, and I think it was James quoting you, so I don't know if it's 100%. But you said, James, that Caroline was one of those climbers who said, I want to kill the competition.
And it's, maybe I wouldn't say kill, but this is,
I think you said
true.
Destroy.
Yeah.
Or annihilate or something like that. It was on the first day that we actually ever really talked.
Yeah, I think that's the way I've been brought up, first of all. I remember.
Yeah, you were competitive in everything in your life.
I mean, my dad's, I don't know if it does matter, but my mom was very competitive, and my dad, he's Vietnamese. And I remember one time I was like, at the end of a competition, being like, oh, yeah, I'll just try that route, and it doesn't matter. And I was 25 at the time, so, you know, a grown-up. And my dad was just on holiday, and he's like, no, Caroline, you're not just doing the route. You're winning. Like, oh, wow.
Okay.
This is where
I come
from.
To win. Yeah. And your mum, she'd always told you that you were the best. You're the best. You're the most special. Yeah. You're the most pretty.
I've been brought up competitive. Like, I had to be the first in class. I had to be the first in everything I was doing. But this is super selfish. And I think I reached that point where I wasn't comfortable with the person I was. I do think all competitors experience this trouble here. I don't think you can be a competitor without being super selfish. Maybe you can. I don't know. Maybe I guess you can put it and put your hat on and put your hat off, but I couldn't do it. And so I knew I had to move on from that because I would just not become a nice person otherwise.
But do you think trad climbing in that way, it kind of helped you?
Like, yeah, because trad climbing, first of all, I stopped competition, direct competition. And becoming a pro climber, a pro trad climber, it was definitely not about who's doing the hardest route. Every route is very different in trad climbing, and every story is very specific. So I could just find my own path. And now our life is completely different. It's about telling stories about the experience we live. And it's really not about who is the best outdoor climber in the world. I'm willing to lose that competition, actually. It's about sharing stories that might hopefully motivate people to want to live stories just like that.
Yeah, going back to what we said right at the beginning of the thing, it's just about to try and... We have... Climbing is probably the best thing that we have in our lives. I always say it's the best gift I've ever been given, but I don't know who actually gave it me. Gave myself, maybe. Just felt like it, going crazy one day, gave myself climbing. But it's the best thing that we have, and if we can share that image with one person, then it's, you know, it's a,
so I think this is
a positive thing to do for...
Yeah, this is the moment where you take a step back and you're like, what is my life achieving actually? I think you said it, but you've got this... Maybe I've heard it, you say it so much times that I don't feel like you put your heart in this, even if this is pretty much true.
Just one of my corporate slogans, yeah.
This, I think, well, I mean, we're six, how do you say? Trillion? No, milliard?
Trillion.
Six
billion.
Billion.
Billion. Yeah. 6 billion.
Milliard.
Okay.
Billion.
Yeah.
We're a lot of people, no? I can't figure out the way to say it in English.
A lot.
And we, let's be realistic, we are useless. I mean, James and I were useless. We're not bringing in anything. And you could say in one bad way, what are we? You could say on one side, we are glorified advertising. And that's quite sad. But you could say on the other side, our purpose is to hopefully get people to go climb more, go be in the nature more. And if they're in the nature more, they're less consuming less in the supermarkets. And
thinking twice about taking that car to maybe choosing the bike over the car
exactly.
next time.
So.
Just somehow opening people's eyes to what might be out
to
there.
How much of a treasure we
and
have
I'm not for
and
one
how
moment.
Much in danger it is as well.
And I'm not for one moment saying that we know everything and we see it all clearly. No, we're just as confused as everybody else. But just to be aware that there are a million and one ways to look at the world that we live in. And the way that people in Sweden see it and the way that people in the UK or in America or in Africa or in Asia, like everyone is so different. And but at the same time, we're all, you know, we're all just trying to figure it out. You said that traveling is one of the reasons that we like to travel so much.
We didn't talk about traveling at all, but that's the one big thing that climbing brought us. It's a gift from climbing, yeah? Traveling.
You get to see the world.
Yeah. But you don't just get to see the world. I mean, when I was a kid, my parents did travel a lot. They had quite enough money to travel, but we'd always go on a, how do you say, tour operator.
Yeah, I guess because ultimately we don't have that much money. We're forced to travel in a way that... puts us in contact, in fact, puts us at the mercy of the local people.
Mm.
And now, you turn on the news every day and you just see horror story after horror story, people being horrible and awful to each other. And people are scared, I think, of the unknown and strangers.
So people
and yet,
are scared
for
of
me,
just buying a plane ticket. Not everybody, but a lot of people are scared of buying a plane
I've
ticket and
nothing...
just going off in a country where they don't speak the language. But
I and we have had nothing but positive experiences from travelling. And when you put yourself kind of in the arms of somebody, most of the time they just want to give you a hug. They're not going to steal your wallet.
Yeah.
And
I think why did it happen in the first place? Because we wanted to travel to climb. So we want to reach that crag, which is completely off the touristic path. So there's no way to book a tour operator. So you have no choice. You have to go for it. You buy your flight ticket and then you're not really sure. You kind of try and plan things ahead, but you can't plan much things. But I mean, we've had, so that's the first thing. We've been forced to climb, to travel off the beaten tracks. And that was an amazing discovery. And I wish that to anybody. And the other thing is, there is a big, I think it's the same in any sport, there's a big universal climbing community. So wherever you go, you'll meet a climber. You can only say a few signs, you've got a few English words in common. But somehow, in a few days, you'll become friends. And maybe next year, he'll come to your home to spend some holidays there. So he's got this very, very different life. He lives in a world that's not your world, with different rules and different objectives. But he will let you inside his world, so you will get to discover what reality it is that you have. I always feel like when we travel, it's like our brain shifts a little bit, and you feel just
building
a little bit less
stupid. Building
new
pathways and so on. Building new,
So that's the real big thing. Now that we're 30, sometimes you're like, do we actually travel to climb, or do we climb to travel? And
yeah. That's the eternal question that we pose right now, I think.
Are you ever afraid of... Well, we've actually already touched upon this, but about being, like, jaded, like, because you get to see all these fantastic places and do these amazing things. Is it difficult sometimes to stay humble? And I mean that both in the sense of, like, appreciating, like, your backdoor climbing route, but also when it comes to exposing yourself to risks. Isn't that a problem to become kind of too overly confident in a way? I don't know.
I think one of my big fears is what's going to happen and how am I going to react when all this comes to an end.
So, well, hold on. Clarify what? Because it looks like you're going to die.
No, when all of this wonderful life comes to an end, and how will I fit back into the real world, how I call it. And that's something that, well, you know, I guess I won't find out until it actually happens. We're trying to, I guess, at one hand, we're trying to make plans and prepare for that. But at the same time, I think simply probably just by traveling and visiting and seeing all these places, yes, it does show you all of the magnificent things out there, but I think at the same time it teaches you to actually be more humble, because you realize that you're ultimately just a tiny part of a huge system that is going to keep on working with you or without you. And so, yes, we are right now living these incredible experiences, and yes, one day we won't be able to travel as much, we won't be able to have all these magical things all the time whenever we want them. And that's a bit scary, but at the same time, you look at it and you realise, well, you know, does it really matter? What does it change? Like, if I'm here or if I'm not, it doesn't change anything. So all I have to try and do is find a way to be happy with what I have in that moment there. Like, don't stress too much about what may or may not be in the future.
Yeah, I think maybe this is the not really searching the great purpose of why are we alive, because maybe there isn't a great purpose and maybe we are nothing and maybe we should just enjoy it
now. Yeah, I think we're just there to exist and make the most of it once we can.
But to be kind of pretentious, what would define, like, being adaptable? Like, what you're describing is about being adaptable, adaptable to life. And isn't that what makes a good climber? Like, if you are adaptable and being able to roll with the punches, kind of, to keep on moving forwards and solving problems and, like,
I don't know whether it's something, I mean, yeah, for sure, it's definitely a positive attribute to have, but I think, you know...
Not just for climbing.
To be
actually
a climber or just to be a person.
Like, climber seems a bit, like, actually useless there, but just to be adaptable seems... It's the first time I think about it like that, but...
I mean, adaptability as a climber, and for sure, as a track climber or in the mountains...
I'm more thinking about adaptability as a
You need
life,
to be able to, obviously, adjust to every situation, the situations that are going to be constantly changing. But I think adaptability in life is, I hope, it's going to be one of the best things that all this traveling is going to give us. And I can imagine why somebody that only lives one existence or one, you know, lifestyle, when things change, I can see why they might have a harder time dealing with it than myself. Even though you could argue that maybe, you know, we have a great life now and it might get worse. Regardless of that, we've
got
learned
perspective.
Yeah.
It's a cliche, and obviously everybody says it's about realizing that you're really lucky. I mean, it's cliches are there for a reason. When you travel, I mean, what is the percentage of a developed country and the percentage of people who live in a third world country? We're just so lucky to have had... Even if it has to stop tomorrow, like, that should be just much more than enough for us. Even if we're going to have the super shit, like, I'm the planner type. So I always plan things. I have got plan A, plan B, plan C, depending on what happens. So in my head, I've planned even what happens if James dies. And it's horrible to think, obviously, if I die, there's nothing to plan about. So that's actually the really easy solution. But if James dies and I don't die, that's the worst situation for me. If we die both, this is amazing as well. But the only way I can get off is just thinking, if James die, it will be all finished, but I'll still know that we've had all this time that was just amazing and unexpected, and we didn't deserve it realistically. So I always try to focus on, like, let's try and keep this collection of memories, and even if it's gone, in one way it's always going to be there.
How do you react? Because in your line of work, I don't know, in your world, tragic events happen to people living in the mountains.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's the deal, yeah.
And I'm sure you both have close friends that are no longer with us, and you hear about accidents and so on. What does that do to you? How does that affect you, and do you ever question your choices?
I think the first thing, again, I come back to perspective. I think our modern developed, super happy and sheltered society has made a really big deal of death. Like, dying before you're 80 is a really bad thing happening to somebody, and we dwell on it for a lot. But you go to Philippines, and I mean, it happens all the time. And people, somehow they manage it. Death is normal. I think maybe one first thing that we've learned with discovering so many places, so many people, is that, well, if somebody dies, it's really sad, it's really horrible, and will be really sad. But, I mean, life goes on, whatever. So that was the first thing. You don't agree?
No, I agree.
I mean, it's kind of down to earth, but it's like, it's kind of when seeing somebody crying and giving him a little bit of a slap in the face and be like, just move on, and that's all. It's just harsh, but I mean, life is not, we just think life is supposed to be easy, but no, life is not supposed to be easy.
Life's not supposed to be fair, life's just life, you know? It just is. Everybody's there doing something, there's no real reason behind it. And I've had close friends die in the mountains, but also had close friends die doing stupid stuff in the city, and also friends kill themselves, and, you know, just like, it's death is death, and whether it's for one reason or another, is it more sad or less sad? I think I'd be almost more sad to see somebody that's lived a very sheltered life and with few life experiences die, you know, doing something mundane, than somebody die in the mountains doing something they love. I think that's a...
But then what's really hard is for the people who remain.
That's always the big problem.
That's the big problem. So I think both James and I, we educate each other onto the fact that, I think we repeat it to each other, while we're living is amazing. If it has to stop tomorrow, both James and I, we're fully happy with that. And I even try to educate my sister on that, because my sister's really not like me. She's a... You could say, stereotypically, you could say she's got a sheltered life. I mean, stereotypically, you could say she's got a normal existence. I mean, she's a really happy person. She's got a great husband, two great kids. But her expectation is that we shouldn't die before 80 years old. If we do, something happened.
Something went wrong.
Keep trying to educate her to the fact that maybe I will die earlier. I don't want to. Maybe I will die earlier, and this is fine, and she must not be sad for me because I did what I wanted. But it's hard to educate her on that. And you did the same with your parents. Well, not so much, but I think you consider your parents are tough and they can handle it.
Yeah, I think they've maybe already come to terms with all that.
I don't think so.
I don't know whether you ever come to terms with losing your child. I guess that's always a...
Yeah, that's another story.
It's something instinctively built in, but... No, honestly, for... My personal view on death is not something to fear or to worry about. If I die walking across the street this afternoon when I leave the office, I mean, it's fine. I've had an amazing life, and I've lived so many incredible experiences.
Well, listening to us, it looks like we're ready to die.
I really hope.
I'd much rather.
I really hope that
I take the 80-year-old deal tomorrow.
I really hope that we continue to have a life like this and make loads more memories in whatever kind of arena that is. But at the same time, I don't find death scary, the prospect of death. The prospect of losing somebody is a lot scarier than the prospect of dying.
Yeah, how do you find a way to be happy all over again with that? This is really hard to go to terms with that, but I guess you just find ways. I mean, that's human nature.
But what keeps you moving forward? Is it the inspiration and the love for the experience? So
instead of walking out in front of a bus this afternoon.
Exactly. I'm trying to pull you back to the light side.
Well, I think it's very simple. We've got an amazing life. So pretty much every hour of
every
our
moment.
Life is amazing. I mean, like right now, put things in perspective. On one side, you could say, oh, God, we just came back from the US and we had only 2 days at home and now we've got to go to Sweden and we've got to do this thing and it's working.
No, Finland. You're in Finland now.
Oh, my God. Oh, see? It's happening all the time. I don't know why.
No, he's making fun of you.
Oh. Amazing. That's amazing. I don't know what's happening in my brain.
She's so used to the fact that she's going to make mistakes. She's conditioned herself just to be apologetic. Oh, shit, I've done it again. I'm sorry.
I got it right.
So we're in Norway.
The north. We're in the north. I can't get it wrong. You lost me there.
Yeah.
So you were moaning that we don't have any time at home and we're in Sweden.
So that's the very French way of looking at things, you know? No, we have to work, la, 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 and we don't have any time at home. Or you can just say, I mean, how great is that to get to visit Stockholm? That's the right city, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we went to see the Vasa
Museum.
Museum and, I mean, that was mind-blowing, really. You guys are really lucky to have it.
We ate awesome food. Reindeer.
We ate awesome
food. When did you eat reindeer?
That dwarf. And,
poor Rudolf. I'm sorry.
Even if it's a really short trip, 3 days, we get to meet people from here.
Even this podcast's awesome. Like, we get to meet you.
Even
and
this
you have
podcast.
You have such an...
Of course it's fantastic.
No, you just have such an interesting life as well. I'd prefer to actually be here interviewing you. That would be almost more interesting.
We'll book you up for later.
But it's so, I mean, just every experience that you live, you can take something interesting from it.
We've never done a podcast before. I've never been in a building with such... This table
it looks
made
super
of,
trendy, isn't it?
It is super. I mean, the floor is amazing. This glass, this is pretty cool. I've got a little bit of an obsession for lights, and there's a light.
The light bulb's pretty cool, eh?
That's super inspiring. Sadly, I don't know how to work.
Should
with
have
metal.
A goldfish swimming around.
That would be perfect. So yeah, perspective. But I think there's really no trouble with keeping us going. You're completely losing it, James.
Running out of time anyway, so
okay so
but what do you see like in the coming months in your life, what's
so
up?
So we always switch years. So last year was fairly focused on my project because it was a big project, required a lot of time, and this year we put more focus on James, so you have
making him a YouTube star.
Exactly.
That's the goal.
Caroline's going to start getting naked soon because I figured out that's the only way I'm going to get ever more than 300 subscribers.
I mean, you chose the wrong wife for that. I'm not getting naked.
So this year, we were just in the US for the last 3 weeks because for the last few years now I've been looking for what I hope will be my next... level of trad climbing, and it's looking for a route that's going to push me further than I've been pushed before, and so we've been searching all over the world for this thing, a lot in South Africa. Recently, we decided to go looking in the US. And
so he's looking for a new route, not an existing route.
And so the problem is, it's always really hard to find a hard climbing route, even if it's sport climbing. Finding a natural piece of rock that's just that right level of difficulty, that has holds in just the right places, is already complicated enough. And then when you have to add to that the fact that it needs to be protectable, because I won't get into boring details about why and anyway, but it's really complicated. So we've been looking a lot and we haven't really found that much.
So he's talking about technical things, but then the thing is, James got his dream in his head of a route that is just about, you know, like that, with that and that. And to have a dream and want to find the reality of that dream is just really hard to find.
But
a piece
of rock.
If
you're allowing yourself to dream, then you allow yourself
sure.
to
but hey,
really
the journey is the reward,
perfection.
Right?
Exactly. And so we've been...
the chase for it.
Oh, 100%. We've been to the US. This is already... that was mind-blowing. Not always positively, but just... Yeah, I mean, in the recent... well, 2017, new president with a lot of things to say, and we went to the thousand
southern.
I can't say that word.
South.
The states of the south of the USA.
The southern states.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was so the climbing aspect of it was to find James Dream route, and the travel aspect of it was to get to try and understand what's happening there, why people...
Is it even possible to understand?
Well, why did people believe what Trump promised? I think you can understand, actually, when you go there, why they believed it. It's just
hope.
Hope, lack of education,
hope,
lack of possibilities.
And ultimately coming down, like you said, to lack of education.
And this is crazy to realize that the first world power is... there, but they are there. I mean, clearly they are.
But we shouldn't talk about politics on this podcast. We're probably the,
I think this
the
is okay
least acceptable.
I don't think anybody in Europe would back Trump now in the media. So
yeah, but it was super interesting. In fact, we went with the question of, okay, in Europe, Trump's obviously portrayed as kind of a clown. And there's I don't think there's any media source that has really positive things to say about him. He's just the same... They portray this caricature all the time. And so we're like, it can't be like that in the US because there's 50% of the population that, well, let's not argue about that, that technically voted for him. And so there's got to be some people that have positive things to say. And no, even over there, we don't find it. But I think that's simply because we live in an age where the media that you see is so tailored towards your own tastes and your own
the filter bubbles. Exactly.
Even if we don't want it, it's pretty much impossible to find.
Not that many people buy a newspaper anymore. Mm. So a lot of people get their news via Facebook.
And it's pretty much automatic
media.
Feeds. Yeah. And so even over there, we were shocked.
Nobody knows kind of the why and what, but...
But with all of that kind of confusion...
So you are running for president.
Exactly.
Let's make it official.
Exactly.
Of which country?
I'm going... My main plan is that I'm going to go and do this really hard trad route.
You know, there's no president.
Make
in the
trad
UK.
Climbing great again.
Yeah, but I'm going to. I'm
yeah, that's the.
You've got it.
I'm going to go to the States.
So we had this cap. And
yeah, we did actually make caps saying make trad climbing great again.
No, real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, did
you?
I can give you
a
picture.
Great minds think alike.
And we had half of the people really laughing. Oh, the climbers, because the climbing community
everybody
is
loved it.
Against Trump.
You know, regardless of what... That was the beauty of those caps.
Some people looked at you like, how can he
Let's
dare do that?
Let's throw a rock at him.
No, I think everyone loved it. Because some people thought we were supporting and others thought we were mocking. And
some people had no sense of
it. In fact, we just didn't realise, what's trad climbing?
And some people couldn't read.
Yeah. So the good news is that on this trip to the States, I don't know if we can say I found the one, but I found the closest thing so far to this dream route. And so we'll be going back at the end of the year to hopefully try
back
and
again in that same country.
Yeah.
I think maybe...
We just can't get enough of it.
I guess maybe already for a French and an English person, it's hard to understand. But then for a Swedish person, it's even to understand the US. But it's all... To me, if I had to... explain the situation in one word, it's just education. Like, education
lack
possibilities.
Of,
yeah. Like in Sweden.
Perspective
have,
and
yeah,
education.
Yeah.
So just keep blabbing.
Thank you so much for a fantastic... The first interview where I didn't even have to use the questions because I kind
you
of...
You didn't use the questions.
Like,
because
you
have to edit
we
this.
Just talk too much.
You hijacked it in the most lovely way. And I'm very grateful for you taking your time.
Well, I'm very grateful for you to listen to our mindless blah, blah, blah. And I pity you having to edit that. And I'm looking up there and I'm seeing those three tracks. Does that mean you edit three tracks separately? Or do you...
No.
Okay,
it's all mixed up in a nice lump.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you can separate them if you need to cut out something that I say over Caroline.
I put the James filter on.
We do speak together very often. Yeah. I think you've noticed, and you're thinking in your head, "Oh my God, this is going to be horrible to edit."
Thank you so much, and best of luck for you.
Thank you very much
for the
Thank
both
you
of
much.
You.
Well, and, I think we'll start listening. Definitely,
you'll have a new subscriber to your podcast.
Yay!
I want to know what
and
Jeff
you can,
said.
Everyone counts,
and you can make ads for me on your YouTube channel.
Maybe I haven't figured out how to do that yet. I'm not there yet. No.
Oh my god, you're
But then, you know, for like the ad revenue that 300 people was going to bring in, I thought it was just not really worth it.
You can find Husky on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at the handle Husky Podcast. Husky is recorded with support from Naturkompaniet and the new holiday club in Åre. The music is made by Joel Mull.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.